Welcome back. The Han and Roman empires both flourished from around the beginning of the 2nd century BC until the end of the 2nd century AD. And as we've just seen over the last series of lectures on Rome, Rome had been founded much earlier than 200 BC. But you could say that Rome really didn't become a power affecting the broader Mediterranean until after its decisive victory over Carthage in 202 BC. And in a remarkable coincidence, that same year, 202 BC, was the year that Liu Bang became emperor in China and founded the Han dynasty. 4 centuries later, the last Han emperor abdicated in 220 AD, while in the West, the death of the Roman emperor, Septimius Severus, in 211 AD, marks the end of the stable succession of emperors and the beginning of a period of political chaos. The Roman Empire would continue to exist for several more centuries, but there's no doubt that from that point on, it's a story of decline. So, while the Roman Empire existed for several centuries before and after the Han Dynasty, its peak is almost exactly contemporaneous with it. Furthermore, if we look at the size of the two empires, they're almost precisely equal. The Chinese census of 2 AD recorded a population of 58 million people, while the Roman Empire at the same date is estimated to have had 55 million inhabitants. In terms of geographic extent, the Roman Empire, at its first glance, seems much bigger. It stretches 3,000 miles from Britain to Mesopotamia, and 2,000 miles north-south. In contrast, the territory of the Han forms a solid square, measuring about 1,200 miles east-west and the same from north-south. But the Roman Empire was really just a coastal empire. It consists of a ring of provinces encircling the Mediterranean Sea. So, if we add up just the area of the land portions and omit the sea, then we find that the Roman Empire occupied about 1.5 million square miles, which happens to be exactly the square area of the Han Empire. The Han and the Roman Empires, though, form an interesting pair for comparison for reasons that go way beyond just those basic facts that they exist at the same time and were about the same size. Both empires had strong centralized governments, and both developed a multi-layered bureaucracy, which were staffed with officials drawn from an educated class of landowners. Both empires constructed impressive road systems, and also huge hydrological projects, which the purpose of which was to aid internal communication and transport. Both empires found themselves threatened by recurrent invasions of nomadic barbarian tribes on their borders, especially their northern borders. And in response, both empires ended up maintaining large, highly organized armies, and they built extensive networks of defensive walls. Both empires brought economic stability and prosperity to large areas, while at the same time practicing intensive taxation, and they both took an active role in regulating vital foodstuffs. Both of these empires also spread an elite culture, and they used social integration into that culture as a mechanism to assimilate outsiders, and really to harness their energies on behalf of the centralized state. Both empires viewed themselves as universal empires, who had a kind of divine mandate to rule over the entire world. And both asserted an ideology which claimed that they were bringing civilization to the regions that they conquered. And they used that as a justification for those conquests, and they also used it as a way to co-opt local elites. Both empires had to endure episodes where they went through weak or sometimes even inept leadership, and both empires were constantly threatened with fragmentation because of internal political rivalries and factionalism. Both empires struggled with basic technological limitations of the time, and a lot of these had to do with how to maintain such a huge empire with the technology that was available. Both of these empires would eventually fall due to a combination of external threats, internal dissension, economic collapse, new religious movements, and endemic disease. And when they did collapse, interestingly, both empires split into two halves. One of those halves, in each case, was quickly taken over by barbarians, while the other half, in both cases, preserved the traditional regime for a long time. And finally, even long after both empires had dissolved and disappeared, each continued to exert a powerful influence on subsequent developments. And this was done through the image of empire that they created. And each empire would serve as an inspiration for, and really a kind of ideal model of a successful empire for future generations. Now, in addition to all those many similarities, there's also some key differences between the two. The Roman Empire arose out of the Roman Republic. And even after the creation of the emperor, aspects of that old republican ideology of widespread participation in government remained very influential. And that was tied in with the, I guess, the semi-democratic system of the Roman Republic, in which you had the concept of citizenship as being a participatory one. For most of Roman history, citizenship was a highly coveted and special status. And it was held by only a small minority of people living within the Roman Empire. So being a Roman citizen brought with it important legal and social privileges. China is completely different. They had no comparable concept. I suppose in a sense, in China, everybody was a citizen. But that didn't bring you any particular extra status. And there was no ideology of political participation as there was in Rome. The Romans were very much aware that there were a variety of possible forms of political organization, ranging from things like the radical democracy of 5th century Athens to the totalitarian god kings of the Near East. But in China, there was really only the single, unquestioned, and universal model of rulership, and that was monarchy. What the Han system of government had, which Rome lacked, was a clear philosophical underpinning that offered a consistent and clear rationalization for the structure of the government. And of course, this philosophical foundation was that fusion of Confucian and legalist thought that played such a central role in training Chinese bureaucrats. Another institution that did play a significant role in both the social and economic structure of the Roman Empire was slavery. And the scale and use of slave labor was much more extensive in the Roman Empire than it was in Han China. Another of the really important differences was that the Roman world was an ethnically diverse and what today we might call a multicultural one, whereas Han China was a single, uniform monoculture. And even though various aspects of Roman civilization spread throughout the cities of the empire, there always were many, many distinct local and indigenous traditions and ethnicities that thrived within the Roman world. And even individuals, they might adopt certain Roman ways, but often simultaneously they would retain their own native language and their local customs. And the culture of one of those groups which were conquered by the Romans, the Greeks, that culture was also widely viewed as a superior one and more sophisticated than the Romans. And indeed, it was one that elite Romans themselves would imitate and eventually kind of fused in with their own. Again, China forms a dramatic contrast. Chinese culture was unquestionably the dominant and the elite culture. But more than that, it was the only one to be found all throughout the Han Empire. So, for example, in the Roman Empire, Latin was the official language of law and politics. But a person just walking through the streets of Rome would have heard a myriad of different languages being spoken. And that same person would see temples, not just to the gods of the Greco-Roman pantheon, but you would have seen dozens of temples and shrines to an amazingly diverse array of exotic foreign gods and cults. It's a little bit ironic that although these two empires covered huge expanses of the globe, and maybe more impressively, between them, accounted for an estimated one-half of the world's population at that time, they seem to have been largely unaware of each other. Their knowledge of one another came mainly from the trade goods that traversed the Silk Road, but there seems to have been no direct contact between their governments, and really only the most dim awareness that the other even existed. And of course, that's due to geography. I mean, by land, Rome and the Han Empire were separated by 4,500 miles of what really was hostile desert and mountains. And even the most direct sea route, which would connect Egypt and, I guess, Vietnam, was about 6,500 miles long. Nevertheless, there were a few moments when these two great empires came tantalizingly close to establishing contact with one another. But none of those chances seemed to have quite panned out. For example, in 139 BC, Wu Ti sent an envoy west to try and form some alliances against the Xiong Nu. And this envoy had all kinds of adventures, including for 10 years he was actually held captive by the Xiong Nu. But he was an intrepid guy. Eventually he managed to escape and get back to China. And in addition to accounts of the various tribes of Central Asia, accounts of the wonders of India, he also brought back vague stories of a large, impressive empire even further to the west. And this may well have been the very first time that the Chinese heard about the existence of Rome. During the later Han period, there were several military expeditions sent westward, which brushed up against border regions of the Roman Empire. And in particular, in 97 AD, one Chinese general actually reached the Persian Gulf. And then he turned around and came back. And when he returned, he brought back information on the lands further to the west, including a description of a great empire. And this was clearly Rome. And according to him, he said, this empire ruled over many smaller states and contained many large cities. And if he had only pushed just a little bit further, almost certainly he would have encountered a Roman outpost. But he didn't, and so what was probably the best opportunity for establishing contact between the two empires was lost. Thus far in this lecture, I've been mostly noting broad similarities and differences between the two empires. But now I want to focus in on some specific aspects of the Han and Roman empires, and look at those in greater detail. And for the rest of the lecture, I'll start by considering what is one of the most basic similarities between the Han and Roman empires, and that is their size. The enormous geographic extent of these empires is, at the same time, one of the characteristics that makes them impressive, but it's also something that proved to be a severe challenge to their cohesion. These were massive political entities, and the fact that their respective governments just managed to exercise any kind of control over such enormous distances is truly an incredible achievement in an era without any form of communications technology. If you think about it, some of the greatest technological advances of the last 100 years have been in the speed and ease of communication. I mean, today we think absolutely nothing of being able to send texts, images, even our voices all around the globe nearly instantaneously. But just stop and think for a moment what life was like prior to, say, 200 years ago. And in that era, the fastest that a message could move was limited to how rapidly a human, or maybe an animal such as a horse, could travel, or how quickly a ship could be powered by the wind. And under those circumstances, traveling 100 miles in 24 hours would be regarded as blindingly fast and exceptional. And really, the standard distance that anybody could travel in a day prior to about 200 years ago was 20 miles per day. So, in the Roman and Han empires, if there was, let's say, a rebellion or a natural disaster or anything else that required the emperor's attention, It might take weeks or even months for news of that to reach him, and then additional weeks or months for his answer or response to arrive on the scene. So that basic technological limitation on the speed of communication in the ancient world constitutes maybe the most formidable challenge that any ancient empire had to overcome. And the way that the Romans and the Han responded to that challenge was actually very similar. Both empires constructed very extensive and sophisticated road networks. Both of them undertook truly colossal public works projects which were centered around improving waterborne transportation. And both empires eventually set up a system of official couriers who would carry government messages. The Romans began work on their famous road network quite early in their history. As I talked about, during their wars to conquer the Italian peninsula, they started building these roads. And by the time of the early empire, it was just standard practice to build an elaborate road in any territory that the Romans acquired. And a lot of this construction work was done by the Roman army. So when Roman soldiers weren't fighting, they actually spent an awful lot of time digging. Roman army units were always accompanied by an engineering detachment, and so that would provide the direction and expertise to create the road system. The main Roman roads were marvels of practical engineering. So first, they would make a deep and solid foundation. Then they would put gravel or sand to provide a kind of base. And finally, the roads were often covered with carefully fitted paving stones. And major Roman highways were usually at least 15 feet wide. And they were built with a crown so that rainwater would just quickly flow to the sides and into drainage ditches. The Romans also had kind of a thing about making their roads straight and level no matter what the terrain was. So if there was a mountain in the way, they would bore a tunnel through it. If there was a river or a valley, they would simply build a bridge across it. And I think it's a measure of the quality of their construction that at least 350 Roman bridges are still standing today. And a lot of those are actually carrying modern traffic. One of the more common artifacts surviving from the Roman world are milepost markers, which were set up along these roads. And they almost always declare not just the distance, usually measured in miles from Rome, but they also proudly list the military unit which constructed them. And the total length of this elaborate road network, counting both the major and the small roads, has been estimated to be about 50,000 miles. And you could say that by the height of the Roman Empire, one could travel every step of the way from Spain to Jerusalem on well-crafted Roman paving stones. In China, beginning during the reign of the Emperor Shi Wang Di, a network of imperial highways radiating out from the capital was built. And in China, it wasn't the army, this was conscripted labor of the peasantry. And this served to link the various parts of the country together. And these were nice roads, they were wide, they had shade trees planted at 30-foot intervals, and the whole system included not just the roadways, but also way stations, inns, bridges, and raised causeways. Now, like the Romans, the Han were concerned with providing good access over mountainous regions. For example, in 63 AD, the officials in southwest Shenxi rebuilt just a little segment of the imperial highway which went through the mountains. And that one project resulted in the construction of 67 miles of road, 5 major bridges, 623 trestles, and 64 other buildings, such as rest houses and post stations. And by the end of the Qin Dynasty, a core network of high-quality roads stretched about 4,000 miles. And then the later Han emperors added on to that. One highway, which was known as the Straight Road, ran in a line 600 miles, and it connected the capital to Inner Mongolia. And both the Romans and the Han emperors set up a post service which consisted of way stations and horse relays and riders which could carry messages from the capital to those outlying regions along the roads. No matter how nice the road was, in the ancient world, transporting goods, especially bulk goods, by water was always much, much cheaper than moving them by land. And so both empires spent a lot of resources on trying to facilitate waterborne shipping. It's been estimated by scholars that the cost of shipping one wagon load of grain from one end of the Mediterranean Sea to the other was actually cheaper than moving that same wagon load 75 miles overland. So water transport's much cheaper than land. And while it's a little bit more costly to move goods along a river than over the open ocean, river transport was still many, many times more efficient than land transport. As you might expect then, most of the food for Rome's inhabitants came in by water. But for a long time, Rome lacked a really first-rate harbor. The available existing harbor of Ostia didn't have a safe anchorage for ships. So in 42 AD, the Emperor Claudius finally tackled this problem by building a new artificial harbor that was 1,000 yards in width, and he just carved this out of the Italian coastline. And this huge basin was connected to Ostia, the port, and to the Tiber River by a whole series of canals. And this harbor was known as Portus, and it did have big breakwaters, but still it seemed to have been a fairly dangerous anchorage. We know, for example, in 62 AD, a storm came by that sunk over 200 ships within the harbor. Finally, though, Rome got a first-rate harbor when the Emperor Trajan rebuilt Portus. And he added on a new inner harbor where ships would be completely safe from storms. And this inner harbor was a giant hexagon in shape, 700 yards wide, and completely lined with very nicely made quays and mooring points and warehouses and all kinds of things. And today, when you fly into Rome, the modern airport is actually partially built over Portus, the ancient harbor. And if you land on the right runway, you can still see that hexagonal basin of Trajan as your plane comes in for a landing. Hundreds of Roman freighters busily plied the Mediterranean, bringing an estimated 600,000 tons of grain, olive oil, and wine into Rome's harbor every single year. In China, the main routes of riverine communication were those two great parallel river systems, the Yellow River in the north and then the Yangtze River in the south. And those two rivers, with all their attendant tributaries, provided a very nice kind of natural foundation for an internal waterborne trade and irrigation network. The problem was that there were certain regions, especially in western China, that were not reached by those two rivers. And the other problem was that both the rivers flowed from the west to the east. And so trade in that direction was easy, but going north-south was much more difficult. The solution to both those problems was simply to dig canals. The canals could bring water to the drier regions, and you could dig canals that would establish north-south links between the existing rivers. And so from a very early date in Chinese history, various dynasties began giant canal projects. And as you might expect, those efforts intensified under centralized governments such as those of the Qin and the Han dynasties. For example, the Qing Kuo Canal, which was excavated by the Qin, opened up almost 500,000 new acres of land to intensive agriculture. And it helped to feed those large armies that the Qin were putting in the field. Eventually, a lot of the existing canals would all be linked together, and they would form one which is now called the Grand Canal. And it stretches over 1,100 miles from Beijing in the north down to Hangzhou in the south. And it's really an amazing public work. It's the longest canal in the world, and even today, it's still used as a main artery for trade within China. All those various segments that make up the Grand Canal weren't fully connected together until just after the Han era, during the Sui dynasty. But most of the individual parts were already excavated and working at a regional level, at least, in the earlier period. Well, despite all of those efforts, those basic technological limitations on movement made sure that the central governments of Rome and the Han could only react very sluggishly and with an enormous delay to any problem that arose in a distant province. Ancient Roman sources include frequent reference to the amount of time it took for information to just travel the roads and sea lanes of the Roman world. And from these, we can kind of calculate the maximum possible speeds for communication in the ancient world, as well as more what would have been more typical times. One of the very fastest journeys that we know of was actually made by a famous man, Julius Caesar, who, in an emergency and really calling upon all of his wealth and the resources that were available to someone like him, achieved a speed of nearly 100 miles per day over land. So that's about the fastest you could go. A more normal rate of travel is suggested by the average distance between inns, how they're spaced along Roman roads. And they seem to always be, quite consistently, 16 to 20 miles apart. And so that strongly suggests that that's the length of an average day's journey along the Roman road system. If you're traveling by sea, obviously the variables of wind and weather could affect your travel time, but it's still possible to say the amount of time it took ships carrying announcements of an emperor's death in Rome to reach Egypt. And looking at those, it suggests that an average time for news to go from Rome to Egypt by sea was about 30 days. And similar to that same rate of travel are comments by the Roman statesman Cicero, who regarded it as a very, very quick passage when letters that he wrote to his son, who was a student off in Athens, made it from Italy to Greece in about 3 weeks. All of that indicates that a Roman emperor who wanted to send instructions to one of his governors on the far eastern or western edges of the empire really couldn't expect his orders to get there in, let's say, less than a month. He would then have to wait another full month for a reply from that governor to come back. So the optimal amount of time for a basic exchange of information in the Roman Empire between central government and the fringes was probably at least 2 months. Now, that even still represents an ideal. It doesn't even take into account the probability that these messages would never even reach the people they were intended for. Roman highways were absolutely infested with bandits who would rob and murder travelers. And sea travel was maybe even more dangerous because not only was there pirates all over the seas, but there were considerable perils to be faced from storms and shipwrecks. And if you look at Roman tombstones, one very common line that you see on a lot of Roman tombstones is the phrase "interfectus a latronibus," which means killed by bandits. Another indication of how big a deal banditry was is that in a surviving list of the duties of a Roman governor, the very first thing mentioned is to suppress bandits. If we look at China, bandits were also rife there. We see them featuring prominently in all sorts of surviving novels, and they're often very colorful figures, at least in the books. In China, the round-trip time for a message from the emperor to go to a border region and get a reply was probably a little bit less than the Roman Empire, but it still would have been something that you're measuring in weeks. In the next lecture, we'll continue this comparison of the Roman and Han empires, and we'll focus in on the systems of administration that each set up in an attempt to try and govern these geographically vast areas. First, we'll look at the various levels of official and unofficial bureaucracies that eventually evolved to do things like control behavior and collect taxes. And then we'll look at the guy at the top of the ladder, the emperor himself, and evaluate aspects of his role and influence in the structure of political power in these two great empires. Thank you.